top of the morning to you. It's a Juno afternoon. I'm your host, Andy Klein, on this St. Patrick's Day of 2017. And today we've got a great show. We're going to be talking to Bjorn Dila about his new work, Haunted Southeast Alaska. Also, Charles Ward will be here to highlight the grand opening of the new Masonic Lodge. Kate Troll will be here to talk about her brand new book, The Great Unconformity. And we'll learn about all there is to know about the Blarney Bash with Jamie Letterman and Kim Masuth. That's all coming up right here on a Juno afternoon. But first, we're going to hear from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton in for Antonia Gonzalez. A state Supreme Court decision in Washington gives tribes the right to transport goods and services across state lines without the burden of state taxes. As Emily Schwing reports, the case is a historic recognition of tribal sovereignty.
The state's high court decision Thursday affirmed the Yakama Nation's 1855 treaty with the federal government that granted the right to travel freely on public highways. Jodé Gaudí, chairman of the Confederated Tribes of the Yakama Nation, praises the court's further interpretation that the treaty exempts the tribe from state taxes.
It essentially strengthens the Yakama Nation's stance that not only existed long ago and was memorialized, but reaffirms it in modern-day time.
The tribe attorney, Brendan Monahan, stops short of calling the case precedent-setting.
But I would certainly call it a landmark case, a historic recognition of the fundamental right to travel and trade guaranteed by the treaty. That's just not a right that has really been recognized by the state of Washington before. Certainly it was not recognized or respected by the state's attorney general, but it has now been confirmed by the highest court in the state of Washington.
The decision stems from a fuel distributor on the Yakama Nation reservation that sold gas well below off-reservation prices by not charging state-mandated taxes. He took the state to court after officials demanded $3.6 million in taxes, fees, and penalties. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Wyoming has a new law that requires the state's public schools to teach the history and culture of the two Wind River Reservation tribes. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports.
When Wyoming Governor Matt Mead signed the Indian Education for All Act into law last week, that marked the end of a three-year effort for Jason Baldes, director of the Wind River Native Advocacy Center.
It's hard to get something like this through in a state like Wyoming, a cowboy state. It's a little bit like cowboys and Indians politically sometimes. And so the fact that we're in 2017 and talking about educating our young people about the tribes that are in the state is unfortunate. But we're very thankful now that we've got this legislation in, and it's a long time coming, and it's way overdue.
Baldes says advocates worked to ensure the bill's language focused specifically on northern Arapaho and eastern Shoshone, with the option to add other tribes to the curriculum later.
The important thing is that we got the two tribes mentioned in there, and that they should be consulted with on the education that's being brought forth by the Department of Education. We need to be able to tell our own stories as the Shoshone and Arapaho people.
Social studies teachers will be able to access Wyoming PBS videos made in collaboration with the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone on the Wyoming Department of Education website. For National Native News, I'm Tennessee Watson in Laramie, Wyoming.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is recognizing 17 men in a ceremony today, a century after they served as code talkers during World War I. Jim Kent reports.
Standing Rock Sioux Veteran Service Officer Menajah Hill says the tribe's World War I code talkers served to defend their people and ancestral lands 7 years before they were recognized by the U.S. government.
They weren't citizens. What they fought for is what they believed in, and that came from the heart. It can't come from anywhere else.
Officials are presenting the posthumous Congressional Gold Medals to the men's families. The Standing Rock Sioux were among nearly three dozen tribes that used their native languages as an unbreakable code to communicate vital information during World Wars I and II. The code talkers were often not recognized at the time because the program was classified. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Bears Ears National Monument, created to honor tribes and protect traditional access. You can tell President Trump to honor tribes and protect Bears Ears at protectbearsears.org.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Alaska Eye Physicians and Surgeons, part of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, work to protect sight and empower lives by serving as an advocate for patients and the public while advancing the profession of ophthalmology. It is important to learn the difference between ophthalmologists and optometrists. This message is brought to you by Alaska Eye Physicians and Surgeons.
Welcome back to This Dirty Old Town. We're here talking to Bjorn Dila about his brand new book. I said it wrong before. Sorry, Bjorn, but it's Haunted Inside Passage, and exciting new book for
thanks.
You just
yeah,
out.
Thanks,
yeah.
Appreciate it.
And you were saying that actually, like, I have an advanced copy here in my hand, but you actually haven't even seen the copy of your book yet. It's going to be
the first one I've seen right there.
There so. You go. It's cool. So, officially out May 2nd, is that right?
Officially out May 2nd, but there's an early release on online orders and also some bookstores, but not Hearthside, just to let folks know.
Okay, that's very cool. So let's talk about it a little bit. Haunted Inside Passage, Ghosts, Legends, and Mysteries of Southeast Alaska. But this is interesting because it's not just a telling of these stories. It's sort of your firsthand account of trying to uncover these stories. Is that right?
Yeah, it's my firsthand kind of investigation and also just a lot of folk stories from northern Southeast Alaska. And also digging in the archives and old stories. But it's kind of a blending of personal experience, interviews, and research.
So what, like, is it like the haunted room at the Alaskan Hotel? Is that one you talk? I mean, like, what are some of the ones you talk about?
Yeah, there's one story deals with the bars in town.
Yeah.
And, you know, combined with, you know, personal experiences, bad decisions I made in Alaskan.
Things that haunt you personally.
Things that haunt me. Listerine will never make that go away. But, yeah, so there's that. And, you know, just all sorts of stories, everything from, Ed Kraus, the first purported serial killer in Southeast Alaska, to, you know, the ghost of the Princess Sophia, stuff like that. So
tell me about that one, the ghost of Princess Sophia.
Well, that story was more of a focus. It's more that was more of
a married couple or something.
Well,
or
that story for me was definitely more. I focused more on two couples that lost their lives. Well, three of them lost their lives, and one, Al Winchell. Came back from, he was out in western Alaska, the city of Flat, this little mining town, and he had promised his wife that if she was to die, she had this premonition that she was going to die, that he would bring her body to be buried in San Francisco next to her mother. So the lady dies, he makes this epic journey, you know, once the freeze-up happens, to Anchorage, arrives in Juneau in December, makes it out to Vanderbilt Reef, on solstice, and the boat company said there was no more bodies to be recovered at this point, and his wife wasn't one of them. So, you know, they're out in Lynn Canal on solstice. Anyone who's been out in Lynn Canal in the winter knows it's horrifying. Anyhow, he's hired this diver, and then right away, the diver finds two bodies in the Sophia, and then this leads to months and months of recovering bodies before Al Winchell finally finds his wife's body. So that's kind of the focus of that story, that along with Walter Harper and Francis Harper, who many people know in Alaska, but they're kind of a legendary couple, first guy to stand atop Denali, and all sorts of really interesting stories, but it follows their line to coming back on the Princess Sophia and tragically going down. So,
fascinating stuff and so many tragic stories associated with that story.
Sure.
Yeah. And then you, so when you refer to this, you sort of say the Northern Inside Passage. So what area do you kind of cover in this book?
I basically start at Wrangell. There's stories from Wrangell to Yakutat, and I had to kind of pull some of the stories from Valdez too to fit in a story essentially about glaciers. But I needed this story during the Klondike of these thousands, 3,000, 4,000 stampeders that were going over the Valdez Glacier, who had been lied to essentially by these steamboat companies, and they're all just, you know, starving to death and dying from disease, and what happens to them while they're on the Valdez Glacier. They start having a hallucination that they're being attacked by an ice demon. And so I had to use that to kind of do a story about glaciers, because glaciers obviously are such an intricate part of Southeast Alaska's history and, you know, even today, the ecology and whatnot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your background as a writer. This isn't necessarily the thing that you typically write about.
No, I kind of consider myself a failed nature writer. it's a brutal occupation. I'm a nature and humor writer, the story behind this book was that my girlfriend was standing in at the Capital City Weekly editor at the time, and she didn't have any features. I had gone to Thomas Bay a few years previously with some friends, and we investigated The Strangest Story Ever Told, which I'm sure a lot of listeners are very familiar with.
Give a little background on that just for folks.
Yeah, it was Harry D. Culp. He came up right after the Klondike. He lived in Petersburg. But the story essentially is all these prospectors going to Thomas Bay. They have these, you know, horrifying experiences with what they call devil creatures, all sorts of weird psychological stuff. And so anyhow, it's become kind of an icon, scary story of Southeast Alaska. And my friends and I had, you know, as so many kids who grew up here, had, you know, read that story, heard it tons of times. And, you know, we had always talked about going and trying to retrace their routes back, you know, where they encountered these devil creatures. And so we did that. And, of course, you know.
What were they like?
Well, there was lots of logging roads, lots of friendly workers, you know, so things change a lot in 100 years,
What's the theory behind people, this collective of people seeing devil creatures? Is there a theory about...
You know, one of the stories addresses that. You know, I talked to a lot of old-timers in Petersburg, and, you know, one of the things that was commonly said about Mr. Culp was that, you know, like a lot of Alaskans, he enjoyed his whiskey and telling stories. So that's definitely one theory. Then there's the arsenic in the water. I mean, there's a power suggestion. Anyone who's been in the wilderness for a long time by themselves, you know, you start getting weird. And, you know, so there's all that. And then, you know, there's all these stories, you know, of Tlingit folks telling, you know, them that there's this bay is haunted, all this stuff, you know. And, you know, a number of Tlingit folks even told me that, yeah, their great uncles or their uncles would not go to Thomas Bay. So, yeah, we went in there, and, you know, it was, I mean, the eeriest place, and anyone who's really ever walked, you know, through logged areas will say that that's, you know, it kind of has a weird feel. But, you know, we didn't have anything too exciting happen to us, not as exciting as going back to Mayfest in Petersburg, and things got a lot more exciting there.
You just kind of freaked yourself out a little bit out there.
mostly we just hiked a lot and had fun. So.
Yeah. So what you were leading on to a next story, what was the weird thing that you were saying?
Oh, Mayfest in Petersburg, if anyone hasn't to Mayfest.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
right.
Things will get weird there for sure.
Right. Well, now there's a mention, in fact, there's even an endorsement on the back of this book from Sasquatch saying that you taught Sasquatch to love again, which is it's a tender
thing. It's a long, lonely job.
Yeah, it's very nice to help Sasquatch with love life. But now, I didn't quite realize that there was legends of Sasquatch in Southeast. I always thought that was a Pacific Northwest thing.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to find that out, too. I kind of, you know, toyed with some articles. And then I got a call from a Bigfoot expert, you know, setting me straight, you know, and so that whole piece was kind of a research in Southeast stuff, but also going down to a Bigfoot conference, which was one of the stranger things I've
I was just
going to
say,
done.
So that's the thing, and I'm not, I don't mean disrespect here to anyone, but when you said a Bigfoot expert called you, that to me just, that's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, what makes you a Bigfoot expert?
It used to funny to me, too, but what's interesting, and just like anything else, it's a belief system, which I really learned throughout this process of writing this book. And, you know, people believe things as strongly as, you know, other people believe stuff that seems more normal. So for me at first, you know, I thought it was funny, but, you know, who am I to say, you know.
Sure, right.
There's worse things to do. You
well,
know,
you know, I mean, you know.
Devote your life to Bigfoot. So.
That's absolutely true. That's true. And, of course, that's become very popular with the reality TV shows and stuff
like
that. Yeah,
I mean, all these reality shows, it's pretty silly. And there's even a story in there, in this book I wrote, about reality television and called In the Spirit of Naked Joe. And Naked Joe was a survivalist that some people kind of consider started this whole reality television. This was long before television was created. But fascinating story, and then it kind of came, that whole wave came into came into Alaska. So
yeah, it does seem like Alaska is a place, you know, obviously the woods are deep and old, and the rain and the mist and the darkness and all those things would definitely lend themselves towards these kind of spooky, creepy tales.
Mystery stories, yeah, and the people, too. You know, we're a different sort of people. We got more stories. We're more out there, you know. And Juneau's civilization, and you go out beyond Juneau, and, you know, everyone's got stories.
Is there one in particular you could highlight just with a couple of minutes? Is there one story that maybe sticks out as one that maybe you didn't know about beforehand and is very strange?
Man, there were so many stories. Because when I started on this, like I said, I was not, I was, you know, a nature humor writer, and, you know, I had a few ideas initially, and then it just kept going and going. But, you know, not the Ed Krause story I found so fascinating, the first, you know, purported serial killer in Alaska, you know, and just how intricate that story was and all the discrepancies. And by the end of it, you're just like, what really happened? I guess the thing that maybe that I was most surprised about this whole project was how many people do have ghost stories. You know, everyone from, you know, any type of person you can imagine. And this project really kind of opened that up, where I'd just be standing in line, someone would be like, oh, Bjorn's working on a book about ghosts. And then the lady standing next to me, you know, would be like, oh, I have a ghost story. And she'd feel comfortable telling me that, which was, it was really kind of interesting to get that window of, like, how many people.
And these are stories often that people really believe. Fervently.
Oh, they totally believe, and there's no linear path to it. It's just like, this happened.
Right.
You know, and just the people that you would think, you could take the most conservative person in the world, and then all of a sudden they'd be like, yeah, there's a ghost in this house's attic.
Right.
And you'd just be like, whoa.
Okay.
You know, and just simply because you kind of opened the door with having that project, you get all these stories, and I found that fascinating.
That's really cool, yeah.
Yeah, I just...
Well, it's called Haunted Inside Passage, and it's going to be available March 2nd here at Hearthside, but also available online already, right?
It's actually going to be available May 2nd, when it's officially published, but there was an early release for online orders, and then also apparently in some bookstores, but I know Hearthside won't have it until right around May 2nd.
Okay.
So.
And you got any event coming up, book signing kind of thing or that kind of stuff? Or?
Oh, I think I will.
All to be announced?
All to be announced.
TBT?
TBT.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, Bjorn Dila, thanks so much for coming in. It's called Haunted Inside Passage, Ghosts, Legends, and Mysteries of Southeast Alaska. Fascinating account of all kinds of ghost stories and Sasquatch and all other kind of paranormal things you can imagine. Bjorn, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
All
appreciate
right.
it. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon, where we're going to be talking about the new Masonic Lodge that has just been built, and there's going to be a grand opening of it tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. I'm here with the master of the lodge here locally, Charles Ward, and also John Bishop is here, who's the grandmaster of Masons in Alaska. So thanks to both of you for coming in, and this is, I imagine, a pretty exciting day for you, right, to have a new lodge. And
it is that,
Andy. Yeah.
It's definitely a very exciting day. We've been looking forward to this for a while.
So let's talk about the history of it. The Scottish Rites Temple that now the legislature occupies was a Masonic lodge for how many years?
It opened in 1928, and then we sold it in 2006. So for almost 80 years, it was where Masonry was headquartered here in Juneau.
Yeah, such an iconic building in downtown Juneau, and most of us have been in there, even when it had dance studios in it, or now when it has the legislature occupying it as well. So for the new lodge, you're people who represent a building and represent that process. So what considerations go into building a new Masonic lodge that maybe is different than other types of buildings?
Well, so for our purposes here in Juneau, and you know, it varies from city to city, but in Juneau, we've got six organizations literally under that one roof. We've got the Masonic Lodge itself, and then we've got Eastern Star, which is a co-ed organization. The Juneau Douglas Shrine Club, I think people are familiar with the Shriners.
Mm-hmm, sure.
If done for no other reason than the hospitals and for the July 4th parade.
The go-karts, we love them, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But the amazing work they do with burn victims, especially in hospitals. Yep.
And then we have the Scottish Rite, and then we have two other organizations
that are youth
organizations. We have Rainbow Girls and Dean LeLay.
Okay.
So we had to come up with a space where we can accommodate all six of those organizations and their varying needs and stuff like that. So we've done that with our new building that's out there. We had a existing structure there that we added on to significantly, and even the existing part's been totally redesigned, revamped. You wouldn't recognize it if you'd been in there before.
Now Masons. Now, is this Freemasonry? Does it encompass
Freemasons?
So tell me, just give me some background on that. I think people hear Masonic Lodge and Freemasons, and we.
Freemasonry is the oldest fraternal organization in the world. Actually, many of the fraternal organizations emulate Freemasonry. It grew from the old stonemasons' craft lodges. And in Ireland, I have visited lodges that are over 500 years old. In its modern form of Freemasonry, this is the 300th anniversary of the forming of the Grand Lodge of England.
Wow.
And by forming a Grand Lodge, that's when a number of lodges went together to form a Grand Lodge. And a Grand Lodge is the ultimate authority. There's no World Grand Lodge. The Grand Lodge of Alaska is as high as you can go in Alaska. If you go to Washington, they have their own Grand Lodge. But nobody has authority over a Grand Lodge.
So, and when did the Grand Lodge get established in Alaska?
This
is a test, I know.
Yeah, I'm trying to ruin 1982.
Oh, okay, great. Now, is it still about stone cutting? Is it still about that, or does it expand out to other people?
What happened is the old stonemasons, during the Age of Enlightenment, to oversimplify this, if I may, started accepting knowledgeable people. People were becoming educated, and people like Voltaire and Mozart and Bacon, people like that started to be accepted into the lodge. And gradually there was an evolution in to where it became, instead of working stonemasons, to speculative masons. And we use symbolically the tools and methods of the old stonemason to exemplify moral principles, to be on the square and on the level.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we use those tools. We use the compasses to circumscribe our desires and keep our passions within due bounds. And this is what Masonry is all about.
Hmm. It's an interesting thing as you talk about it, because I almost wonder that term "be on the level." Was it the Masonry? Was it the Masons that influenced that?
That's
it's a direct.
Yeah, right.
Many terms like that.
Right,
that
I can imagine. Such an old and venerable kind of institution in multiple societies.
Yeah, of those phrases that we use in common day parlance, most of them came from one of three sources: the Bible, Shakespeare, or Aesop's Fables. Of the rest, most of those have some kind of Masonic
history
to them.
Isn't that wild? It's amazing. There's all the wild stuff about Masons and, you know, national treasure and all that stuff, right?
There's an element of truth in that. And that's enjoyable reading. And where they've taken some liberty with right. things, it's not totally fictitious. They've made a good story using some Masonic principles.
Yeah.
I often tell people, you really want to know something about Masonry, go read the Declaration of Independence. It espouses Masonic principles through and through. And that's what inspired it.
Yeah, interesting. So that with that root in Masons and stonemasons, is there a consideration for how the building should look for the representation of it? Because many Masonic lodges have that. Kind of going back to, and I even think the Scottish Rite Temple and Lodge has that kind of, you know, really substantial look to it. So is that something that, what kind of considerations did you go into in the design of the new building?
Well, you have, there are some principles you try to adhere to. At the same time, you have practical considerations.
And you have
the weather in Juneau, which is going to be different than the weather maybe in Arizona or someplace like that. So you have to have those considerations. But you have a lodge room. That if you can't literally lay it out east to west, you lay it out symbolically east to west. You have a cornerstone that we laid 2 years ago, almost two years ago now. That we had a ceremony for laying that we put in a certain spot, and then we have other elements of the building. I mean, they're not hiding anything, but I could go on for days about
that.
In frontier America, oftentimes in the frontier towns of the West. You know, 150, 200 years ago, there was an expression. In every town, there's a little white church, a little red schoolhouse, and a little blue lodge. And oftentimes, the lodge building was the second floor of the schoolhouse, which the Masons built the schoolhouse, because public education is one of the things that we're very much promoting and always have. And that principle that to be educated was necessary in order to have a democratic republic.
Yeah. Well, so for the opening tomorrow, if people want to go to it, tell me about some of the festivities and stuff that's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure. So you talk about some of the ceremonial things and things like that. So at 11 o'clock tomorrow, 9315 Glacier Highway is where our new lodge is located.
And that's kind of near the Valley Restaurant?
Yeah, right
area.
Across the street from the Valley Restaurant. Yeah.
Okay.
So where the paint store used to be, right next to that. So you'll get to see one of those ceremonies that we do. It's completely open, nothing secret, hidden about it. That ceremony takes 45 minutes to an hour to perform, but it's actually, you know, a way of dedicating the building to our Masonic work and to our Masonic principles and how we're going to use it for what we hope are good and noble purposes. After that, we're going to have an open house, so people can come, they can see the new building, they can ask questions about the building, they can ask questions about Masonry, they can ask questions about our different organizations. We'll have food and drink, so you know, obviously you can come and nosh as well if you want to do that.
Great.
And it's all indoors, so I'm hoping we get good weather, but it being Juneau, it could be good weather 1 minute and not so good the other.
My guilt.
So
okay.
I would, but people don't need to worry about the weather. It's going to happen, rain or shine.
So, all right.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, it's interesting. Dedication is very similar to a cornerstone laying, and of course, Brother George Washington laid the cornerstone for our nation's capital. And actually, the Grand Master, 4 years ago, when I was first in the Grand Line, we went to Washington and we got to open lodge in the George Washington Memorial. And I actually got to touch the gavel and the trowel that Washington used.
Mm.
And so there's a symbology here that is true in all of this, and the dedication is much the same. We use corn, wine, and oil to consecrate the building. And it's a great opportunity for people that are just curious about Masonry. You know, we really don't have that many deep, dark secrets. You have yours. You're not going to give anybody your credit card or bank account number.
Right.
And it's identity. And that's what we preserve, is our identity. You're welcome to know who's a Mason, but the things that by which we can prove ourselves to be Masons are the secrets. But the real secrets, if you get into it and study it, the things that are really secret, just take study. It's in every public library. You just have to dig.
Hmm.
And it's a fascinating subject.
Well, a great way to get introduced to that would be to head over to the grand opening of the new Masonic Lodge. It's happening tomorrow at 11 a.m. and followed by a open house. And John Bishop and Charles Ward, thanks for coming in and letting us know about it. And congratulations, and have a great grand opening.
Andy, thanks for having us in. Appreciate
All right.
it.
Coming
Thank
up you,
next,
Andy.
Yes, here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 17th of March, 2017. St. Patrick's Day, feast day, celebrating patron saint of Ireland, St. Patrick. Born in Wales, he was 16 when a group of Irish pirates came to the village and took some of the young men, including him, back to Ireland as slaves. He worked for 6 years as a herdsman, then escaped, went back to Wales. But he heard a voice telling him to go back to Ireland and convert the Irish to Christianity, which is what he did after spending 12 years in France. He went to Ireland, founded monasteries, schools, and churches. And so New York City and other cities put on St. Patrick's Day parades. New York's is the largest, 150,000 marchers going up Fifth Avenue, led by the 69th Infantry Regiment. New York has been parading on St. Patrick's Day since 1762, Boston since 1737, and Dublin since 1995. It's the birthday of the playwright Paul Green, born near Lillington, North Carolina, 1894, wrote a successful Broadway play in Abraham's Bosom, and did a stint in Hollywood, wrote many screenplays, and wrote a line that Betty Davis considered her favorite line, "I'd like to kiss you, but I just washed my hair." It was on this day, 1917, the National Gallery of Art opened, Washington, D.C., the project of Andrew Mellon, the industrialist and Secretary of the Treasury. In 1930, Mellon had the chance to buy art from the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, Russia. Stalin had ordered the museum to raise money for the government, sell off valuable pieces, and Mellon was there. He bought 121 paintings, including work by Raphael, Rembrandt, Botticelli, and Jan van Eyck. In 1936, he wrote to President Roosevelt offering to donate his collection as well as $15 million to build a museum, a neoclassical museum in Washington. The architect John Russell Pope. Construction began June 1937, and neither Andrew Mellon nor Mr. Pope lived long enough to see it completed. They died in late August 37, within 24 hours of each other. The National Gallery, admission always free to the public. More than 4.5 million people visit it every year. And it's the birthday of the novelist Penelope Lively, born in Cairo, 1933, author of The Road to Litchfield, Treasures of Time, and According to Mark. Grew up in a suburb of Cairo, studied history at Oxford. Her novel Moon Tiger won the Booker Prize in 1987. A book in which she wrote, "We open our mouths and outflow words whose ancestries we do not even know. We are walking lexicons in a single sentence of idle chatter. We preserve Latin, Anglo-Saxon, Norse. We carry a museum inside our heads. Each day we commemorate peoples of whom we have never heard." Here's a poem for today by Gary Soto, entitled Field Poem. When the foreman whistled, my brother and I shouldered our hose, leaving the field. We returned to the bus, speaking in broken English and broken Spanish. The restaurant food, the tickets to a dance, we wouldn't buy with our pay. From the smashed bus window, I saw the leaves of cotton plants, like small hands, waving goodbye. poem by Gary Soto, field poem from his selected poems published by Chronicle Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Here with someone else wearing green. Kate, well done.
Thank you.
Kate Troll is here with me, author of the new book, The Great Unconformity. And Kate, you were just showing me a really fun thing, which is sort of some other folks, people that you know or just authors that you admire. You kind of sent out the book to a few people and got their comments back. You said that was one of the most nerve-wracking parts
of
the whole process.
It was. You know, finally you work on this manuscript and you revise it and you get it done and you're consulting people along the way. So the rewrites and the revisions take a lot of work, and then finally you think, I think it's good enough to send out. And then that moment comes when you send it out to writers and other policy people that I really respect. And many of them said, yeah, send me the manuscript. I'll read it for you. And they wanted it in paper, interesting enough, you know.
Yeah. That is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, because writers like to work on paper,
sure.
You know, and stuff. So.
Well, you mean you're really flipping through that many pages. It's kind of tough, unless it's Kindle ready, I guess.
Well, it is Kindle ready. But anyway, so sent them the manuscript. And as I was saying to you, you know, they could have just said, oh, a nice, interesting read. Add this to your shelf. But instead, they really liked it. And people like, you know, Heather Lende, who is a New York Times bestseller out of Haines.
Wonderful author,
she says, if you don't mind.
No, it's a fun.
Yeah. To read The Great Unconformity is to spend time with Kate Troll, a wonky, funny, bossy, passionate, wildly read, and accomplished outdoors woman who is delightful and inspiring company. If you only read one book on climate change and what you can do about it, make it this one. If you read them all, it deserves a place in your library. Better yet, don't keep it on your shelf. Pass it on and join Kate in her quest to save the world she loves.
Yeah, that's
pretty powerful.
Great. That's really nice. It was fun to hear you read that first sentence, though. It must be hard to listen to someone quote what they think about.
She wanted to apologize. She says, I hope it's okay if I said bossy.
I like wonky.
I like the wonky part. I'm a policy wonk, you know. And well, I told her that bossy was fine because my kids will like that.
Well, this book is about your sort of observations about climate change as it relates to our local area? Or tell me a little bit more about...
Yeah. The subtitle is called Reflections on Hope in an Imperiled World. You know, I felt like I have been immersed in this issue for the last 10 years, and of course, all we all have out in our backyard is what I called our bold, barren barometer of climate change, the Mendenhall Glacier. So it's sort of been in our face for a while, and having worked the issue, I kind of know the core elements, but also reasons to be hopeful. Why can we still really meet and address this challenge? And because I am a wonky policy person, I actually take the time to read Al Gore's book, The Future, which is about 4 inches. It's a tome, you know. Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, that's another really big book and goes faster. Anyway, I take their sort of cogent policy insights and I wrap them up in my adventure stories. So you're climbing Denali with me. We're running the Tatashini Alsek. We're running the Grand Canyon in winter. And my writer friends that I got to know through 49 writers, and particularly someone like Kim Heacock, writer from Gustavus, really encouraged me to make it more of a memoir.
First person kind of, you're kind of almost like a flow.
Right. So I started when I first came to Alaska in 1977. Yeah, because I came up here with my fancy master's degree from Yale School of Forestry and charged off and went to Haines and tried to do the Haines Coastal Management Plan and got confronted by this logger that asked me this question, what good is an eagle if you can't eat it? You know. Yeah.
They're delicious.
They're delicious.
I mean, they are delicious.
No, but it was sort of my first professional trial by fire, and I realized how I answer this question really makes a difference. And it's not a question they ever prepare you for in graduate school.
You know? I don't know if it's a good question, really.
Well, it was back then.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
Anyway, so there's a whole story wrapped around that, and it kind of is when I realized I needed to look for the linkages between economic development and environmental protection. And so it sort of helped my own philosophy about how I approached the resource issues through the rest of my career. So that's kind of,
yeah,
you know,
it
one
is
of the
that,
first stories.
It is that thing that really guides policy, isn't it, is finding that common ground, I mean, you know, between those two issues.
You're right.
You know, especially in a resource extraction heavy place like Alaska.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So I think.
And you, when you came up, I mean, that and then the coming next two decades was the heat of the battle of T-Lump and Tongass Man, all that stuff was. Those
was
are
all
people
going
have,
on D2 fights,
yeah.
Battle land, yeah.
I mean, people have war wounds, you know, still from that, you know.
I have a couple of those.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a tough battle.
Right, right. So I get into a little bit of that in the book, but I also really wanted to try inspire and motivate the millennial generation. Because we're kind of leaving this world behind in a bit of a mess. I mean, my generation, I'm a little bit older than you, Andy.
I think we're baby boomers, I would say,
exactly,
though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's you know, there's a part in the book where I kind of really apologize from the deepness of my heart. But I want to do more than that. I wanted to show some what I would call hope spots on where we really are making progress. And inspire them as to pick up the mantle and address this, what I think is one of our most pressing challenges.
Now, you have advanced degrees in the science fields, and but you thought it would be best to approach this as a journal instead. You thought it was that was the tool to use. Tell me why. What went into that decision? You obviously got encouragement from your writer friends, as you said.
Well, I like to tell stories. Mm-hmm. I like to, you know, I've been on mudrooms a couple of times, and so storytelling is something I really enjoy. But the other aspect of my writing that I feel like I'm pretty good at is being a columnist. I was writing for the Juneau Empire for about 5-6 years, and now writing for the Alaska Dispatch News. So
having an opinion, having
yeah,
a real
so
expressing
it's like,
an
you know,
opinion.
I like
yeah.
to tell stories, but I also like to make a point. And this was a way of kind of honoring both those voices inside me. And the other thing that I learned from talking to the writers, memoirs sell better than anything else.
Oh, okay.
And it's a top-selling genre. People are interested in that. So
give the people what they want. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it forced me to kind of open up my heart a little bit to go back into some of my old journals and really talk. So there's a personal narrative arc that goes through the book, as well as an adventure story arc of coming to Alaska, climbing Denali, running wild rivers, kayaking among whales, those types of stories. And then at the same time, there's this policy thread where I start with the really harsh facts about what's going on and then talk about developments that are uplifting and hopeful and where are we making the biggest changes, in my opinion.
Mm.
So it's kind of a little bit of a roadmap, and that's why it was kind of challenging to find a publisher because it didn't slot easily into any one of those categories because it is current events. It's memoir.
Right. It's more than just a personal memoir.
Yeah.
It's more than just that, and that's part of it. But it's also not exactly a scientific journal or that kind of thing either.
No,
and
it's,
so
yeah.
it's kind of this weaving, and that's, it makes it sounds like it's so fascinating.
That's what I hope to be.
Yes.
It was challenging writing, trying to weave those three narrative arcs, you know. And the adventure writing is the storytelling. And I think when you can entertain people at the same time that you're trying to explain something that's kind of complicated, it sticks a lot better if it's wrapped up in a story.
Well, when will it be available?
Thanks. I will be doing my first book signing on Hearthside on April 7th. It is up on Amazon right now, but it's only in the Kindle version. The paperback for purchase, it should be on Amazon in about 4 days.
Okay.
I will be doing e-blasts to all my friends and Facebooks and everything when that happens.
Sounds great. Well, Kate Troll is the author's name that we've been talking to, and The Great Unconformity is the name of the new book, a mixture of a travel adventure and personal journal and an opinion piece on
policy wonk.
And policy wonky stuff too, all mixed in together, kind of all circulating around the idea and the topic of climate change
and sustainability.
Yeah. Kate Troll, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about it, and good luck with the publishing of this new book. It's exciting.
It's exciting for me as well.
Yes.
Thanks, Andy.
Here comes Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. You'd think that with so much green in nature, many birds would be wearing the green for camouflage, not just on St. Patrick's Day, but every day. Yet very few of our birds cavort in Irish green. There'd be some wee exceptions, however. Some of the hummingbirds, with their backs of bright green. This tiny Anna's hummingbird is a bird of the West. When sunlight catches its throat and head feathers, an iridescent flash of rosy red gleams from this green bird. This one may be called the black-chinned hummingbird, but the surprise is the flash of iridescent purple when the sun strikes its chin just right. This green bird summers from the Rocky Mountains to the dry southwestern desert. The ruby-throated hummingbird covers the eastern part of the country, the green male flashing its brilliant red throat as it hovers for a moment in the sun. Unless you're in one of the Great Plains states, one of these hummingbirds is probably coming your way soon. Watch for that flash of glittering green.
Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for spring planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the luck of the Irish, about St. Patrick's Day, and the Blarney Bash is a great place to go celebrate St. Patrick's Day. It's being put on by the new Rotary Club in town, the Juno 58 Degree Innovators Rotary Club, and the Blarney Bash is happening at the Red Dog downtown tonight, 7 p.m. You guys don't need to put on the headphones. Don't worry about it. You can if you want, but you don't have to.
I'm gonna mess up my hair.
Oh, I know. See, it happens to me too. I get headphone hair. That's why I wear this hat. We're here with Jamie Letterman and Kim Massa. Thanks to both of you for coming in and letting us know about this. So this is gonna be fun, right?
We're super excited.
Yeah. So very good. It's gonna be at the Red Dog, which is a great saloon, a good Irish pub, and it's when it wants to be. And is there gonna be green beer?
Absolutely.
There's going to be green beer.
Of course there's going to be green beer. And everybody who comes in gets a free green beer.
Oh, well, that's great. Okay, so it's called the Blarney Bash, happening tonight, 7 p.m., Red Dog Saloon. Tell me about it. So you guys, the Rotary Club's putting it on. So does it benefit someone in particular? Benefits the Rotary Club, or how does that work? Which goes to scholarships and things like that, or
well,
tell me about that.
At the moment, we have identified, because we are new, so we're starting small. We've identified some of the local nonprofit organizations who have some wants, needs lists, for lack of a better term. I know there's a name for those, but some smaller things that we can help. You know, we can't help in a big way yet, but anything that we can do.
Yeah, and so What are some of the things going to be happening? I see all these. I see this poster with great stuff on here. Tell me about some of them.
There's a ton of stuff. Okay, so first of all, the ticket gets you a green beer, gets you in the door, gets you some corned beef sliders.
What?
And sauerkraut with some. Let's see, what do we have? Nachos. We're having bacon wrapped jalapenos. Who doesn't love bacon wrapped stuff? some veggies, and then there's going to be karaoke. So kamikaze karaoke. Do you know what that is?
I don't. It sounds like elimination karaoke or something. Is that what happens? Or?
Well, I've never played it myself. However, I'm pretty excited to see it happen. So the idea is that you come in and say that you are just like the diehard Journey fan and you want to sing Open Arms.
Okay.
So that's what you're going to sign up for.
Okay.
But you're going to get up there and it's going to be an awesome Neil Diamond song.
Oh, you mean they just throw whatever song?
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
So then there's only 12 slots, so it's pretty coveted right now. And there's cash prizes.
I love this cash prize. First prize is $75 in the kamikaze karaoke
contest.
Just
for singing. And
just for singing a little bit.
Yeah.
Just for getting up there and embarrassing yourself.
That's right. And there's a photo booth.
Oh, cool. All right. And then tell me about this Irish whiskey tasting.
Yeah, we also have Irish whiskey that'll help you get started for the kamikaze karaoke, and maybe
right. It always helps.
Add to the photo booth fun as well.
It doesn't help the performance necessarily, but it helps you get on stage.
Makes you think so.
It makes you think so. Yeah, very good.
That's right. So, do you know some of the different whiskeys that are being tasted? I see some Tullamore here on the poster, but
I
not sure.
I need to admit,
we're
not a whiskey drinker.
Connoisseur.
Okay, very good. But Red Dog is setting that up, yes. And Tullamore Dew Irish Whiskey is part of the, it looks like Hellcat Maggie Whiskey is also being served, so I see those two on the poster.
And there's also, I've heard that the Hellcat is super awesome. So
okay, all right.
Don't know.
And this is all being put on, as you guys were saying, by the Juno 58 Degree Innovator. So tell me about that new Rotary Club. It's a very kind of exciting thing, the first new Rotary Club in years and years and years in Juneau, right?
Very long time. So there's a lot that goes on in the big Rotary International world that, you know, might be really boring. However, Rotary has really recognized that we need to get with the times. There's a lot of younger people out there, a lot of different mindsets, a lot of technology, a lot of new stuff coming down. And in order to continue to attract memberships, we've got to learn to be more versatile and be more flexible and no more fines for looking at your phone during a meeting and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's no evening meeting in Juneau. So
there is now.
Yeah, there is now. Yeah, thank you. So we meet just twice a month, the first and third Wednesday. So it's
Thursdays.
Thursdays, thank you. Maybe Kim should talk about the new Rotary
Club. No, it's good.
Yeah, yes, so we meet the first and third Wednesday. You got me. Thursday. And we rotate between town and the valley. The town location has been El Sombrero, and valley we're still trying to find a good fit, a good spot that's going to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as we get that figured out, we'll try to get something set so it's permanent the first and the third Thursday of each month, and we've got that posted on our website. So if anybody would like to come visit one of our meetings or consider joining, we'd certainly love to have anybody.
So tell me about this name, though, the Innovators. Is that the focus? You want people who kind of are in that space of wanting to be change agents or innovators or things like that? Is that right?
That was kind of the idea, and we did a lot of – there was a steering committee of five of us who met for several months prior to being set up officially as a new club. And we went through a lot of different names, and we kind of settled on Innovators because we thought, you know, what's our name going to sound like in 50 years?
Yeah, right.
You know, and there was a lot of different things that were kicked around, and we really felt that hopefully Innovators was still valid as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
But and 58 Degrees, of course, that's where we are.
And are there ideas about putting technology to use in some of the meetings and things like that, or?
We're really focusing on using the technology that is in place. There's a lot of companies out there that are targeting Rotary specifically.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
All of the clubs have what we call Club Runner, which is kind of our, you know, central, which Kim mentioned, our website. You know, the Juneau58Rotary.org is all run by Club Runner, which most Rotary clubs, at least in the U.S., do go through Club Runner. And that program facilitates a lot of stuff like the registration for this and knowing where our meetings are. Since we're not set right now, mm-hmm. you have to, you know, pay attention to your emails. You have to go to the website. You have to look at the calendar electronically to see where we're going to be. And tracking our attendance and doing all of our dues is all electronic now. We're not accepting any, well, I guess if you give us cash, we'll take it. But.
Yeah, twist our arm. Well, that's really cool, and congratulations on setting that up. I know that was a lot of work and a lot of long time kind of put into that. And a really fun way to celebrate with folks is the Blarney Bash. It's happening tonight. It's at 7 p.m. It's $30, $35 at the door, but can people still go online?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
People can still go online?
You can stand outside the door and go online if you want. I don't care.
Bought the ticket right on. And this includes these great sliders and a green beer, and then there's going to be an Irish whiskey tasting, and there's going to be, you can buy Blarney bags, and you can have a be part of the contest, the karaoke contest. So all this great stuff going on, happening tonight at the Red Dog. It's all being put on by Rotary, and the Rotary Club is the Juno 58 Degree Innovators. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in, and have a great Blarney Bash. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be awesome.
Right?
Hope to see
thanks
you there.
To Jamie Letterman and Kim Masseth for coming in and telling us all about all that's going on there. It's going to be a great time. And we're going to hear a little bit more now from the Pogues. That's it for Juno Afternoon for today. Andy Klein, your host, with you. Thanks so much. Get out there and have a little bit of luck of the Irish today on this great St. Patrick's Day here in Juno, as it seems a little bit like the weather is going to maybe hold for us here. Enjoy your weekend, everyone.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion in Ledina.